excited to be here discussing these ideas with all of you. Thank you for coming. I also wanted to take this opportunity to publicly thank Bianca and Laurent and Lee. I'm really delighted to be spending this extended visit here at the Perimeter Institute. And already in the few weeks I've been here, it's been a real pleasure. So thank you. So today I want to discuss instabilities. Gravity is full of instabilities. So the collapse of a star, the formation of the universe, all these really intriguing instabilities. And quantum gravity seems to have these instabilities too. So in particular, when you take quantum effects into account, black holes can evaporate. And I'm curious if there's only one mode of evolution or if there's more than one way in which this can happen. So the traditional way of looking at this is through Hawking radiation. And the calculation that inspired me to get thinking about these things is Hawking's calculation of the lifetime of a black hole. So just to review that quickly, he calculates first the temperature of the black hole. So the Hawking temperature goes as the inverse of the mass. And then you make a simple assumption that the black hole is losing energy through radiated power. And so you make a Stefan Boltzmann sort of estimate. So we say that the power radiated is the area times the temperature to the fourth. And this gives you 1 over m squared. And so then what Hawking does to give an estimate for the lifetime of the black hole given this radiation is to say that the energy change of the black hole is proportional to that power lost through radiation, and hence goes as 1 over m squared. And then you can get a time scale just by integrating this up. So integrating this, you find that the lifetime of the black hole goes as m cubed. So this is not lost on any of the people in this audience, but the approximation in this calculation is very unusual. You're making a sort of, I've been calling it a hybrid approximation. You're treating the matter degrees of freedom completely quantum mechanically, but the geometrical degrees of freedom, the gravity degrees of freedom, you're treating in this classical update fashion. So each time you let off a Hawking particle, you immediately evolve to another Schwarzschild black hole with a reduced mass. So the question for me is about whether this hybrid approximation is valid over this whole time scale. We don't use this approximation in many other problems involving quantum mechanics, and it's not clear to me that this is valid for the whole lifetime of the black hole. So that's what I'd like to explore. In particular, you've probably done this calculation. For a solar mass black hole, the lifetime is 10 to the 75 seconds. So for comparison, the age of the universe is only 10 to the 17 seconds. So this solar mass black hole lives an extraordinarily long time. So we can understand what that time scale is about if we think of the Hawking radiation as a tunneling process. And so Parikh and Wilczek have made this precise. And this tunneling process accumulates many, many low probability events, and hence this takes a very long time. So the question that I've been exploring with Carlo and thinking about is whether the geometrical degrees of freedom can also experience the tunneling process. So can we view another decay mode as being a black hole forming in the past, transitioning through a quantum gravity regime, which I've indicated by this silvery bubbles in the middle that we don't understand yet, and then a white hole in the future. So my talk is going to be primarily with this model in mind. This is not completely new to Carlo or I. This was explored by Tuft and Whiting and also by Hajicek and Kiefer. So this idea has come up again and again. And the question is, can we give ourselves a calculational framework where we can say more about this process? So that's really the goal and intent of the talk. And so I want to give that to you in three parts. The first part is going to be outside of gravity completely. I just want to go and understand tunneling processes again in quantum mechanics in a different way so that I might be able to apply the techniques to gravity. So I'll tell you a little bit about Picard-Lefschetz theory, but I think you've been hearing a lot about Picard-Lefschetz theory because this is sort of a center for thinking about those things right now. And what I primarily want to do actually is broaden the context a little. The semi-classical literature that relates to Picard-Lefschetz theory, I think, has not been really explored recently. And there is a rich literature in semi-classics about this. So I want to try and make that connection for you. The second part of the talk, I want to briefly describe this metric that Carlo and I constructed, which explicitly gives you a classical metric outside of this quantum region where you can start to try and formulate calculational questions about quantum tunneling of black holes. And then I'm still in the midst of trying to do a path integral calculation in that context, and so I don't have results to present to you about that calculation. But I was surprised to figure out with one of my undergraduates at Bard that in fact you can treat the rotating case much like the Schwarzschild case. So you can do almost all the steps that we did to construct this metric for Kerr, the much more astrophysically relevant Kerr black hole. So in the last part of the talk, I want to tell you about this metric for rotating black holes. Okay. So if I wanted to try and understand Picard-Lefschetz theory and its connection with semi-classics, let me just give you a quick review of semi-classical ideas. So people often say that there's no classical correspondent to tunneling. And I think this is not strictly true. I think this is majorly exaggerated. So how do we do quantum mechanics in general? How do we approach quantum mechanics classically? So before the advent of quantum theory, Bohr and Sommerfeld thought about the energy levels of a system by considering the action along the classical trajectories of the system. So if you take that action and you require only that you consider trajectories such that that action is an integer multiple of Planck's constant, then you actually have this nice periodicity condition that gives you a good WQB wave function. So this can be actually seen as a way to get the energy levels of the system. That is, you calculate the action as a function of energy, you set it equal to an integer multiple of Planck's constant, you invert for the energy, and you have your levels. There's a correction here, which is an interesting correction. This is called a Maslov index. And it plays a rich role in the theory, but that's maybe something more technical that I can discuss with anyone that's interested. So there's a beautiful paper of Einstein's from 1917. It's one of the few that doesn't get read. But this paper asked, well, can we generalize this to multidimensional systems? Sommerfeld and Epstein had already considered that, but they were working in a very representation-dependent way of doing things. So they were considering, for example, central force problems, and they were saying, oh, you can generalize Bohr-Sommerfeld. You just work in the angular direction, in the radial direction, you can make it work out. But they couldn't figure out how to do this in general, and Einstein was really bothered by this. He said, I shouldn't have to describe my central force in those coordinates. I should be able to change do any canonical transformation I want. So following Poincaré, he introduced the dot product of the momenta with all of the coordinates. And he noticed that in the phase space, if you take all your conserved quantities and set them to fixed values, you get a torus. And so your independent quantization conditions are the integrals of this full form. This form is invariant under canonical transformations. So it's the integral of the full form over the independent cycles of this torus. And this gives you a representation-independent way to quantize multidimensional systems. So this is a beautiful paper. In the same paper, he anticipates quantum chaos. So it's really worth reading. In 1917. This was rediscovered twice by Brillouin and by Keller. And that's where the B and K come from.
Is there no half here?
It depends. I'm being a little bit sloppy. You have to be careful about which cycle you're talking about. It has to do with the projection onto the configuration space. When that projection is singular, you get a Maslov index, and when it's not, you don't. Okay, so that's just background for what I really want to tell you about, which is that tunneling is also manifested in these classical systems. So this is beautiful work by Stephen Cray. I think this is virtually unknown, but he did the same sort of approach to multidimensional systems, but thinking about tunneling. And his idea was to complexify the phase space variables. So you let Q and P now be complex variables. And still, you consider, well, let's take an example, say a quartic oscillator, and let's consider the energy level set. So in the classical dynamics, if I choose a real energy, the real dynamics is just stuck in this well and stuck in this well. So depending on your initial conditions, you only evolve in those places. And you have two degenerate energy levels here if you do the semi-classical quantization. So Cray says, let's extend our variables to a complex phase space. And if we do that, well, let me, for example, look at the momentum. I can consider it as the square root. Now the V is this quartic potential, and it's got a complex variable in it. And in particular, P will have branch points wherever that shifted quartic under the square root vanishes, right? The branch points of the square root. So I can put those roots in the complex Q plane, and I'll choose branch cuts between the roots, between pairs of roots. And I can extend this into a Riemann surface. So it's a square root branch, so we know that it's just a double two-sheeted Riemann surface. So I've got the two sheets there on the left. And if you carefully label what happens when you wind around the branch points, you can glue this thing back together and get the Riemann surface. So this is a complex version of the condition H equals E. H equals a constant. And again, if I compactify the complex planes as you normally would, the one-point compactification, we get a torus. It's now a torus in the complex phase space, space of complex Q and P. And so this torus, again, has two independent cycles. And remarkably, if you repeat the calculation, again, you have to do these careful things with the phases. But if you track those things carefully, you find a connection between the action integral around the cycle C1 and the action integral around the cycle CT. And this connection is what I've written explicitly here. So what does this encode? Well, I can kind of think about this energy level as an average plus a deviation from that average. So here would be the dashed line would be the average value that was degenerate before I took any tunneling into account. That deviation should be small, so I can expand to first order. And recalling that the derivative of the action with respect to energy is just the period of the orbit, you find that the difference, the splitting of these two energy levels, is given by e to the action integral along this complex cycle. And this is exactly what people would call sometimes the non-perturbative splitting of these two energy levels. It's due to tunneling of the wave function from one well to the other. So this gives you an excellent semi-classical approximation to that tunneling. The two levels you can think of as the symmetric and the anisymmetric combinations of the function that's localized in one well.
So you use this semi-classical, problem is that you cannot do that in a given expansion in each bar. So you need to have another notion of how you order things.
Yeah, so I want to return to that. Can I come back to that in a little while? There's a nice picture of these things more generally. Okay. So I'm trying to motivate for you the idea that we might complexify variables. Yeah?
I'm trying to understand sort of the philosophical claim you made, which was that you can get tunneling classically. I guess what you're really saying is you can get it semi-classically.
Absolutely.
You can get it in the context of the old quantum theory.
Yeah.
Instead of the new.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. What I mean is that I can do action integrals on the phase space, and still I can encode aspects of tunneling and things like that. But you're absolutely right, semi-classically. The condition is very much motivated by quantum mechanics, right? Because I'm asking for single-valuedness of the wave function upon going around these cycles. So it's very much motivated by quantum mechanics. So when you first encounter this, I don't know, I think maybe I am struck by the same question that students sometimes ask about quantum mechanics, which is, why do we use complex variables in quantum mechanics? And so the same thing you could ask here, well, how you just complexified Q and P, why did you do that? What else should we complexify? Why just those variables? So to try and think about that kind of line of question, I want to turn to the path integral and think a little bit about the path integral. This is where we get into the topic of Picard-Lefschetz theory. And I think for sort of first encounters, which some people may have in the room, it's best to treat an analogy first and just think of a one-dimensional oscillatory integral. The path integral, of course, is infinite dimensional, and it's tricky to think about. So for describing Picard-Lefschetz theory, let me take that case. Let me take an oscillatory integral. So I is our oscillatory integral. It, as you know well, mostly gets contributions from critical points. This is because away from a critical point, this thing is rapidly oscillating and the integral is canceling out. So you want S near a critical point in order for this to get its dominant contribution. And the nice thing that's a generic statement is that critical points of a complex function are in general saddles, or critical points of one of the pieces of the complex function. So if we take that exponent, I'll call it E of z, and break it into its real and imaginary parts, s plus I, s tilde, then the Cauchy-Riemann conditions tell us that the derivatives of those two pieces are related to each other. And so the critical points will have, if I want to understand what kind of critical point it is, I can look at the second derivative. And just using these Cauchy-Riemann equations, I find that it must be a saddle. The second derivatives have to have the opposite sign. So this shows you why these are generically saddle points. Of course, you can have non-generic extrema as well. It's a little bit more of a calculation, but it's not too bad to show. Well, let me say that the next slide shows this. So this is extremely helpful for understanding the integral itself. To do this integral, what we'd like to do is go down a steepest descent part of the saddle. So on the one hand, you can think of that as I go far out in the z-plane, I want to have the integral converging. So I want to go to places where the real part, that's the e to the little s, the real part is damping down the integral. So I'm going to try and seek paths in the complex plane where the integral converges. And we can do this by introducing an auxiliary metric into the complex space and looking for the gradient flow of that metric. So the gradient will, if I take the negative gradient flow, I can find the paths of steepest descent. And it's a nice and not too hard calculation to check that along these gradient steepest descent flows, the imaginary part of this exponent function, S twiddle I called it, is constant. So that's a calculation, and once you show that, then you can pull it out of the integral, and we're asking for the integral along this steepest descent.
By the way, I don't know if you want to point to it, but there is that hockey stick there that's...
Okay, thank you. So one of the contributions of Picard and Lefschetz, and it's very nice, is to understand the homology of the curves in this diagram. So I've labeled the steepest descent contours J. These are often called Lefschetz thimbles. Thimble is a hard word to say clearly, but it's what sewers use to cap their finger so they don't stab themselves. The idea is that that in the multidimensional case, instead of being these contours, you get these whole thimbles worth of steepest descent. So this Lefschetz...
Are they also called basins? In some of these, you know, in catastrophe theory, I think they're also called basins of... attraction or whatever.
Sure, yeah, if you're thinking about the region where it converges. Yeah. The thimble refers to these, in this case, these contours. So what Picard and Lefschetz did, which is very nice, is they studied the homology of these curves, and you can show that the intersection between a steepest descent contour, one of these Lefschetz thimbles, and a steepest ascent contour, like these K, I've called them here. This is stolen from your friends. the intersection number is fixed. So if I have an initial real contour for my integration, say the x-axis here, a way to understand what I'm doing when I deform my contour into the complex plane, I know I can do this by the Cauchy theorem, And what I do is I try and preserve the intersection number between this steepest ascent contour and my initial contour. And that tells me which is the right contour in the complex plane to do the integral along. So in particular, I can take my initial contour. In general, there won't just be one saddle. There can be multiple saddles. And I can decompose it into a sum over Lefschetz thimbles. The n here is just 1 or 0, depending on whether I intersect the contour, the steepest ascent coming from that saddle. And I decompose my integral into a sum over Lefschetz thimbles. Does this make sense? So this is the heart of the Picard-Lefschetz theory. Now, depending on whether you want to make a semi-classical approximation or not, you can approximate this integral. So I can do the Gaussian portion of this integral, and I can recover this semi-classical expression, which is a sum over Lefschetz thimbles of the Gaussian, the value at the critical point. Last week or the week before, we heard from Giovanni and his collaborators about doing Borel resummation and thinking about these things at more orders. Okay. So this is sort of a philosophical point, but I think it's an interesting one. There's nothing in the path integral that says that you can't have a critical point which is a complex trajectory. So from this path integral perspective, there's no reason not to consider complex classical trajectories in the path integral. And so Turok emphasized this point. For example, if we think of the final wave function as not just the path integral, but also an integration over initial conditions, you can take a variational approach and consider which is the best initial condition to approximate this path integral. And in general, you'll find complex boundary conditions. So you're kind of being pushed in that direction even by the path integral to consider complex trajectories. But again, I want to try and motivate some of this from the semi-classical perspective. And I want to tell you about old work on the semi-classical approximation to the path integral. So this is known as the Van Vleck-Gutzwiller formula. And I'll call it VVG, just because that's a bit of a mouthful. So what they did is they developed a semi-classical approximation to this path integral. It turns out that it's a sum over classical trajectories of the action. You can think of this really as Hamilton's principal function. It's the action evaluated on that classical trajectory, right? So it's labeled by the boundary conditions. So from here out, I think I'm careful to use q as the variable, the position variable, and x's as my boundary conditions, just to distinguish the two. So x initial, x final, and some propagation time.
And you're allowing them to be complex.
And you're going to allow them to be, well, so the traditional work on Van Vleck-Gutzwiller did not. And so the question is, what happens when I allow all these things to be complex? So the history of this is kind of interesting. So at the top there is Eric Heller. So Heller and Grossman considered trying to do below the barrier calculation. So if you choose an energy below a barrier, what happens when you use this Van Vleck-Gutzwiller propagator? And they were saying, well, there's more than one initial condition, more than one classical trajectory that connects my boundary data. One of those trajectories goes over the barrier, but that one, if I just use that single trajectory in my Van Vleck-Gutzwiller propagator, I get a very inaccurate approximation to the quantum one. At the same,
is just one.
Well, it's the only one that's real. So if you're going to restrict yourself to real classical trajectories, you find that it does not do a good job of tunneling. Several authors around the same period, Robert Littlejohn being one of them, noticed that if you work in a coherent state representation, you can't even get classically allowed processes to work very well unless you use complex trajectories. So unless you allow complex trajectories when you're working in a coherent state representation, this Van Vleck-Gutzwiller formula gives you bad results all the time. For many years, Carl Bender has been exploring.
What does it mean working in a coherent state representation? Do you have a different notion of trajectory that you're integrating over now? Or
I mean, if we think of the quantum process of propagating from one coherent state to another.
If you choose for the initial and final states.
Coherent states.
That's what you mean.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And then we ask, can we do a semi-classical approximation to that propagation? And they find that unless you use complex trajectories, you get a terrible, terrible approximation. Carl Bender has been exploring these ideas for many years. He has considered most often, for simplicity, I think, real T, but complex energies. And he gets very interesting classical behavior. It's a generalization of classical mechanics because he's allowing energy to be complex, but it looks a lot like tunneling. He sort of gets a generalization of wells in the complex plane, and you get these classical trajectories that oscillate around in one well, go around and come into the other well and hang out there, and the time scales are super slow, and there's all sorts of analogies. Ankerheld and Seltzer required a real T, just to see what would happen along the whole trajectory. And they had a lot of trouble meeting these complex boundary conditions that we were talking about. If you set up a situation where your path integral favors complex boundary conditions, you try and require real T along the whole integral, you can't make it work. You can't always meet your boundary conditions. So this kind of was a very problematic issue about this issue of what should I complexify. So I want to present an argument of K's, which I think is a consistent perspective and very interesting. OK. So here's one way of thinking about this Schrodinger propagator. I can think of it as a Fourier transform of my energy-dependent Green's function. So in fact, from this path integral perspective, it was the Green's function that people treated semi-classically first. This is the famous work of Gutzwiller. So Gutzwiller found a semi-classical approximation to the energy-dependent Green's function, which is, again, a sum over classical trajectories, e to the I action, where here I mean the energy-dependent action, integral of pdq in this sense, and it has this form. So here the propagation time, capital T, I've written it, is a function of your boundary conditions and your fixed energy. Again, you can just do this calculation. The energy derivative of this expression gives this expression, but this is exactly dq over the velocity, so this is the propagation time. Okay, so what I wanted to do, because I wanted to understand Picard-Lefschetz theory as a warm-up to trying to do quantum gravity calculations, was really work through this in detail in an example. So at first I tried to do the inverted harmonic oscillator. This was with one of my students from Bard. And the inverted harmonic oscillator has all sorts of subtleties that make it very tricky, surprisingly. So the model potential that we finally settled on was just choose V0 over Q squared. It's a little bit less nice than something that would be non-singular at the origin, but I'll tell you why this is a nice choice for studying these questions. Okay, so in this case, there's no doubt that there's no real trajectory, right? It's not a finite barrier. So I can't even do that first strategy. I can't choose to work with one of the trajectories and see what happens. So how should I understand what I'm doing? If I look in the complex T plane, what I can think of what I'm doing is I'm running in real time for a while, and then at some point I hit the barrier, and I can turn into the complex T plane. And I can evolve along a complex and a pure imaginary value of T for a while, and then keep evolving. So along this vertical segment, I switch the sign of my square root, and I get a pure imaginary contribution to the propagation time. Okay. I'll come back to what that x was in just a second. So if we take this strategy, we try to evaluate the Feynman propagator as this integral of the energy-dependent Green's function. We're doing this semi-classically, so we're happy to make a Gaussian integral approximation here. And so again, this is an oscillatory integral of the type we were just discussing.
So this q dot t, q dot zero, it's a coming from the Von Vleck.
Yeah, from the Goetz-Wheeler formula for the Green's function. So again, this is oscillatory. So we said we want to look at the critical points of the exponent function. And so you take the energy derivative of this exponent function. Again, the exponent function is just negative et times the action. T here is this boundary condition t. It's the propagation time I'm considering. So when you take that derivative, you find that the propagation time that I'm considering has to be equal to the propagation time calculated along the dynamical trajectory. That's the condition for this integral to be stationary. But the boundary condition, presumably, you impose a real propagation time. And we just noticed that in the calculation along the trajectory, to get through the barrier, I had to get a complex value of the propagation time. So the idea is to notice that this t is a function of the energy. So the only way I can meet this critical point condition is if I allow the energy to be complex also. If the energy becomes complex, now this propagation time can become real, and I can meet this critical point condition. So the argument here is that if you're going to have any semi-classical approximation to this thing at all, you have to complexify the energy. You'll notice that once you complexify the energy, I was using energy conservation all over all these expressions, solving for p in terms of the energy and things like this. Sorry?
Why do you prefer to complexify energy?
I'm doing both, right? Because I'm allowing myself to propagate into the complex t plane. So I complexify time, and immediately I have to complexify energy. Why do I complexify time? I can't get under the barrier unless I do. But then energy conservation forces that you have to complexify p, because we've written the momentum in terms of the energy. And as soon as you have a complex p, you're moving off into the complex plane, so your q becomes complexified also. So my resolution to this problem I was stating is that you should complexify everything. It's not really consistent to only do one. OK.
What do you mean in terms of causality to have complex time? Is there an interpretation, something?
Yeah. I've asked myself this question many times. I don't have a good answer for that question. He asked, what does causality, for example, mean in the context of a complex t parameter? What I'll say again explicitly in another slide or two is that somehow analytically continuing classical mechanics encodes more structure. And what I'm trying to communicate is that it's non-trivial and interesting structure. So I don't have a direct physical interpretation of what that complex time should mean or that complex energy. But it's encoding the same sorts of structures as are showing up in quantum mechanics. So what I wanted to point out is I drew this X in that T diagram that we were just looking at, that complex T plane. What is it? There's a way of thinking of it as a branch point of the p and q variables. Explicitly, what I do is I ask, at what point in the q plane does the potential blow up in the complex q plane? And if I carry out the time integral from whatever initial condition I set to that position where the potential blows up, I get a value for t. This t is this x. And it acts as a branch point for these complex p and q. And so again, thinking about Cauchy's theorem, I know I can deform this contour in different ways. But one way in which I cannot deform this contour is pushing it over that branch point. So this is partly what I was just saying, Laurent. This structure in the complex plane is encoding some of the things I can and can't do. So in particular, as we were just exploring, by changing the value of E, I can deform this contour back into a real boundary condition. I just can't push it over that branch.
But isn't it the other way around, that all integrals that you start with are only along the real line, and then you deform them using Cauchy's theorem. But by deforming them, you can never deform them over a singularity. But
so,
you seem to do the opposite.
So for the moment, I'm not speaking about the path integral. I'm just speaking about trying to solve equations of motion with complex trajectories. So what I'm telling you is there's a generalization of a trajectory, which is not along the real T line, right? If I'd stayed along the real T line, I never would have gotten under the barrier in this problem. So this generalized trajectory takes you into the complex T plane. It takes you into the complex T plane in a way that is Cauchy non-equivalent to a real T.
Trajectories are allowed to begin with, also those that go below the barrier.
Good. That's what I'm advocating. Well, how do you want to describe it? It's up to you whether you say, well, what I want to say is one way to describe a trajectory that goes under the barrier is using complex variables. That's what I'm saying.
Is it equivalent to other ways of describing it?
Which other way? I think I'm advocating for this being a super simple way to do it. I know it sounds a little bit, it's not physically obvious what you're doing, but it's a very rich, structured way to do it.
It seems like kind of a trick that kind of masks what's really happening in some way.
Okay, I'll tell you why I'm interested in these things, and if you have a better way to do what I'm interested in, I'd love to hear it. Let's say it that way.
You could represent lots of dynamical systems as geodesic systems in configuration space, right? You can
sure.
use Jacobi method.
Yep. Yep.
And when the energy barrier is too high, this Jacobi metric would become itself complex.
Yeah.
And then the.
That's where I'm going. Is I'm going to try and consider complex metrics
right.
as a way to give a semi-classical approximation to this gravity process. Where I don't know quantum gravity theory. So I don't know the full theory and I don't know what to do with it.
Right.
So I want to use this as a way to try and approach that problem.
The coordinates themselves, the configuration space itself is real, but the metric on it would be complex.
Yeah, so that's something I'm thinking about very hard right now. It'd be fun to chat about that. Should we do both? is one better than the other?
In reference to the previous question, you're probably not trying to deny that this is in the end just an approximation to the Lorentzian or whatever you want to call it, the real path integral.
Yeah, I'm saying this is a technique for evaluating it. I can't do the...
Yeah, the question is could you enlarge the story you're telling so that you somehow saw this as a Picard-Lefschetz or some other kind of
That's right.
approximation to the path integral?
That's right. I'm really taking that same perspective I gave on the oscillatory integral and trying to say how might this work in the context of the path integral.
So if you could do that more explicitly, I think it would answer that question.
Thanks. That's right. Okay, so I promised to tell you the result of a calculation on this. So one of the reasons that you like the inverse square barrier is that you can calculate the quantum mechanical Feynman propagator explicitly. So this is the result. It's a modified Bessel function with index nu given by the strength of this inverse square barrier. But also, you can carry out the classical manipulations that I was talking about completely explicitly. So I can find the Hamilton's principal function for that inverse square barrier. And the thing that's really particularly nice about this inverse square barrier is that I can also invert the energy for the boundary data. That's something that in many other examples, it's very difficult to do in practice. So here's an explicit expression for the energy as a function of this boundary data that I've fixed. So, does it work? We're using complex trajectories here, so I'm allowing everything to be complex. And it works extraordinarily well. So this is the real part of the propagator. The blue curve is the exact expression I showed you from quantum mechanics. And the orange curve is a superposition of two complex classical trajectories. We're in this inverse square case, So I have to have complex trajectories to get through the barrier. And you can see the superposition of the two mattering a lot. You see the slow variation of the curve, but you see it's superposed with a faster variation. So you need both of those trajectories for it to work properly. OK, so I hope to have convinced you that there's at least interesting things within this complex approach. There's a beautiful, much longer story, which kind of gets to what you were asking about, Laurent. A recent paper of Gerald Dunn's, where they look at perturbation theory, and they look at non-perturbative effects at all orders in h-bar. And they study every quartic potential. If you solve for the momentum, these quartic potentials are all elliptic curves. So I can always find their Riemann surface. It's always a torus. And the two action integrals along the independent cycles of this torus are always related by a Picard-Fuchs equation. So the Picard-Fuchs equation comes from thinking about this elliptic curve as a function of the energy parameter and asking for analyticity in the energy parameter. These two actions are always a solution to a particular third order differential equation you get out of that. But what it shows is that there's a relationship between them.
Sorry, but if you go back one, you told us that you superimposed two solutions. What were the two trajectories that you...
There are two independent solutions to this. So I didn't emphasize this. Thank you. Look at this energy function inverted for the boundary data. You see that there's two energies that are allowed. So two energies meet my boundary conditions. And the superposition.
For each one there's a trajectory?
Yeah, for each one there's a trajectory. So this Picard-Fuchs equation connects these two things. And what they show is that you can find, you can understand the H-bar series evaluation of these two full, of the action at all orders in H-bar. You can understand its connection to this dual action, this action along the other contour. And you find really interesting perturbative, non-perturbative relations. So that's outside the scope of my talk. I'll just say that much.
Is it actually related to some Legendre transform, or it has nothing to do?
No, it's really related to this complex analytic extension. I don't know of any connection to Legendre. OK, so I want to describe this metric somewhat rapidly, because many people in the room have heard this before. So let me just tell you the idea that Carlo and I had. What we were thinking about initially was just what happens if I send a shell of light in towards a mirrored ball. So I'll approximate the mirrored ball as having negligible mass. This is definitely an approximation, but I just want to understand what happens. Well, of course, this shell of light coming in is self-gravitating, and so it starts to experience a time dilation effect when it bounces off. And so it slows as it comes in, because of the self-gravitation, bounces and comes back out. So you can ask, I'm just calculating this in a Schwarzschild space-time where the shell has mass capital M and the mirrored ball has radius A. So I can ask for what is this bounce time, that is the time from when you first encounter the shell to when you re-encounter the shell, or I'll cut that in half since it's symmetric. So you find the following result, which is that it depends, the bounce time depends on where you are in the space-time. And if I take the large r limit, I recover the sort of natural bounce time, r minus a. But as I take the limit that the mirror's radius comes down towards the Schwarzschild radius of this shell of light, this gets longer and longer and diverges in the limit.
Can you just repeat, little r equals a is the radius of the ball?
Of the mirror.
Mirrored ball?
Yeah.
The other one is the...
Is an observer who's out at whatever radius they're at. And they ask, how long does it take from when I first encounter this shell to when I re-encounter it? So the thing that we thought was remarkable about this was that this time diverges as the mirror gets close to the Schwarzschild radius. That means that from the outside, this looks like a very slow motion explosion. We send in a light shell, it takes for long, 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 and then finally this light shell comes back out. So that long time means that there's a potential for even a small quantum effect to accumulate. So we do a very naive estimate here, and this, the naivete of this estimate is what makes me want to do something much more rigorous. But the naive estimate is, let's try and imagine what quantum corrections would come from this slow bounce. So the naive estimate is just to build something dimensionless that has what we think the quantum effects are in it, the curvature scale, for example, and use that as an estimate of how classical my space-time is throughout this bounce. So the classicality parameter we put together is just the Planck length times a measure of the curvature scale. We're going to use the Kretschmann invariant, since we're thinking of this as a Schwarzschild solution outside of the light shell. And that's multiplied by the time for this bounce. So that gives you a dimensionless quantity.
Can I challenge you on this classicality parameter?
Yes.
The classicality parameter would be the action divided by Planck length square. So, which means that you should multiply that by the volume of the region you're talking about divided by Planck length cube.
Yeah, so.
Which is a huge
I understand.
Factor.
Yeah, so I have two responses. One is that this came from thinking about modifying Einstein's equation by an h-bar dependent piece. So that's, the idea was if a small effect could accumulate at the level of the equations of motion, over this whole time. So that's partly where it comes in as a different idea. The second is that, as you were pointing out yesterday, in gravity, the action shows up in a different way than in other theories. And so the question is that still the right classicality estimate? And I think you're right to challenge me on this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with, yeah.
I think
the second point is true. I was making it, but I mean, naively, the classicality parameter is right.
Yeah, I'm saying this.
Here you're multiplying. It's like you're taking an action that you're multiplying by h bar.
Yeah, I wrote explicitly. This is naive, and I mean it explicitly. It's very naive. We want some estimate here. I don't fully understand what the right thing to calculate in the gravity case is, and so I'm using this naive estimate. So,
one reason to vary it is that it's proportional to the square root of Planck's constant, which isn't naive. It suggests a non-perturbative effect.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't scare you.
No, it doesn't scare me. I'm trying to think through whether this is a good estimate or not, and I think there are arguments that it's not, but I'm curious about some of the scales that it exposes. That's what I would say.
Yeah.
If you took the square of it, would you reach different conclusions?
No, for everything I'm about to say. In fact, in the Kerr, the rotating case, which I'm going to have to speed up to get to, I do take the square of it. There's a reason you have to take the square of it. So I think I could work with the square.
The issue is not the square for me, it's the volume factor. Like, usually classicality, there's a scaling due to the number of degrees of freedom, which is the volume divided by the Planck length. So this number is humongous for big objects, and that's why, big objects are not...
Yeah. Yeah, so we've discussed this before, and I agree. Of course, we don't expect a car to tunnel into the room right here. One of the things that I was trying to emphasize at the beginning is the timescales are super long here, and that you can have accumulation of small tunneling effects. And so what this estimate is trying to get at is that possibility, is could we have some of the degrees of freedom of the gravitational field tunnel slowly, have that accumulate into effect where I'm not asking for the black hole to tunnel into this room. I'm changing the geometry of the background such that the matter can come out of that geometry. So this is trying to investigate that possibility.
Q is also a function of R.
Yes, so that's what I'm about to say. So this is a function of the bounce time, which I labeled by R explicitly, so we saw that it was a function of R. So the question is where, if we take this as a measure of the classicality of this geometry outside the light shell, where is this most quantum mechanical? That is, where is Q close to 1? And so you can look for the maximum, the radius at which this Q is maximized, and you find that it's a macroscopic distance outside of the horizon. So part of the ingredient into this idea of black-to-white hole tunneling is that maybe the effect starts outside of the horizon. In one way, this is in response, you could see this as a response to some of the firewall arguments, this reductio ad absurdum. You have to give up something outside of the horizon. So we're saying that the semi-classical field theory is something you could give up outside the horizon. Okay, so if you require that Q gives 1 at this radius I just mentioned, you find that the time that it takes to re-encounter this light shell is m squared. So this got us thinking about this set of ideas. So if I put it differently, we wanted to ask ourselves, what if Hawking radiation is subdominant to some other quantum gravity phenomena? So the idea was perhaps the dominant process is energy conserving. So whatever energy matter you send in to form the black hole, that same energy matter comes back out. We're going to neglect Hawking radiation as a second order effect. And then the motivation is that this could be a slowly accumulating quantum process of the gravity degrees of freedom. And then finally, take this to be a time reversal invariant phenomena. So the idea, the schematic of the idea is take a black hole, time reverse it, get a white hole, try and understand what it means to glue these solutions together. So you can do this. This is nicely achieved by just taking the usual Kruskal solution, thinking of a double cover of that Kruskal solution, and cutting it up as follows. So I take this dark gray region, which is the future black hole, and then the light gray region, which is the past white hole. Imagine untwisting those two pieces. You end up with this region here. And then on the interior of the ball of light, which is spherically symmetric, you just can glue in Minkowski space. So this gives a solution everywhere outside of a finite region. This is the finite region where we're imagining quantum gravity dominates, of a black hole turning into a white hole. To show you schematically how we do this gluing, the nice thing about gluing along light sheets is that you just have to make sure the metric agrees and the tangent spaces automatically agree, a result of Israel's. So you just describe the light shell in the Minkowski metric, describe it in the Kruskal metric, and then you glue the two pieces together, and you have a solution outside of the quantum gravity region. Okay, so this metric sets up boundary conditions that are nice boundary conditions for the sort of path integral calculation I was mentioning before. So the thing that I find interesting about this is that this metric has been around in people's thinking for tens of years, but nobody wrote down an explicit metric where you might be able to do a calculation. Nobody that I know of. So what I'm investigating is taking complex solutions to the Einstein equations, to the spherically symmetric reduced Einstein equation in a sort of MIDI superspace approximation, and trying to interpolate between these boundary conditions I'm imposing by this metric. These complex solutions should dominate the path integral and give me a way to approximate the amplitude of this process. So that's the work that's in progress. And I just want to wrap up in the last few minutes by mentioning some things about the rotating case.
Sorry, you want a complex solution whose boundary data are real? Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, so yes. Mm-hmm. So you do the same thing in the 1D case I was showing you. You choose real boundary data, and then you interpolate with a complex trajectory.
Well, then you made the energy real complex, and then you said that made the P complex, and that made Q complex in the end. So in the end,
you could use complex. What's nice about the full complexification is that you could relax this boundary condition and make it partially complex too, if you wanted. So that's fine.
I guess the question is, if that the boundary data is supposed to represent some initial and final classical solutions, there's some classicality there of initial fiber. What does it mean to complexify that?
So one way to think of this is that let's say we're doing WKB tunneling again. So we have classical turning points. Where do those classical turning points happen? They happen at P equals zero, right? And so what we do when we glue the WKB wave function in the classically allowed region to the WKB wave function in the classically forbidden region is we take advantage of that P equals zero point as a place to glue those two solutions where P becomes complex in the other branch. What I was trying to respond to Rafaela is that now that we're allowing complex variables, you don't have to be so strict about using P equals zero as this gluing condition. So I could use an extrinsic curvature equals zero slice as of my gluing condition, but I don't. Now that I'm allowing these complex solutions to be very general, I don't have to do that. I can generalize my k equals zero slice to something more general.
But it is still going to be real.
The picture I just presented showed a k equals zero slice as an example of this, and it's a freedom I'm allowing myself to retain in the calculation to change that boundary condition if it makes the calculation more tractable.
So would you be happy if the solution was complex everywhere but sort of asymptotically went over to Schwarzschild?
Yeah, and I don't know the answer. I don't know how far out I'm willing to let that complexity go.
I guess that's a question really.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer.
Classical, where is it that you want to recover classicality? So the P equal to zero point for the WKB is you have a very well-separated classical quantum regime.
Again, going to the quantum mechanical analogy, I know that it doesn't, I can actually change how much is classical because I have this Cauchy freedom, right? I can deform my contour. So the idea would be that actually I should be able to let myself deform onto the classical part at a variable place, and I don't know what's the best strategy. Should I stop? Should I skip the rotating?
You have 5 minutes.
I have 5 minutes? Okay. So this is just the slide, the news from yesterday, just because it's fun to put the news from yesterday up. So the most recent black hole merger is now on their plots. I was super impressed they'd already updated them by last night. In all of these cases that we've seen of these stellar mass black hole collisions, the end results are consistent with rotating black holes. So I just wanted to point out that astrophysically, we think that all the things out there are rotating. So it becomes kind of essential to ask, well, if you want to try and do some phenomenology with these ideas, it becomes important to ask about whether you can do this in the rotating case. So in quick summary, here's the Kerr metric. The singularities are at rho equals zero and delta equals zero. The first term looks like sigma equals zero could be singular, but if you actually work out that, it's not. The delta equals zero are coordinate singularities. They give you the outer and inner horizons. And here again is the Kretschmann invariant, and it shows that rho equals zero is a true curvature singularity. So the rho equals zero gives you this this ring singularity at the center of the Kerr metric. The geodesics, this is a historical story that's super interesting. The geodesics can be solved for explicitly here in a really beautiful way. So you can treat them by Hamilton-Jacobi theory. And you would expect from counting constants of the motion that this would be a hard thing to do. But Carter was super bold and just said, let's try and separate the Hamilton-Jacobi equation, and it works. And you get another conserved quantity. People often call it the Carter constant. It's a beautiful conserved quantity. It's one of these phase-space symmetries. It's like in the 2D oscillator. So this thing actually generates orbit motion into orbit motion. The point is you can solve for the geodesics. And then you can ask for null geodesics. And there's a particularly nice class that don't change the theta angle of the Boyer-Lindquist. So these are like penetrating. You send these in, they just penetrate straight into the black hole. These are called principal null geodesics. Unfortunately, the principal null geodesics form only a congruence. They're not hypersurface orthogonal. So you can't build light cones out of them. there is no light cone for these principal null geodesics. So this was addressed in a beautiful paper by Pretorius in Israel from 98. I was like, oh, this is so cool that this problem was solved just a few years ago. So what they do is they allow the Carter constant, they take this congruence, and they allow the Carter constant to vary as you move around in the congruence. And by doing that, they can build a hypersurface orthogonal set of null geodesics. That's what's pictured here. The blue curves are, this is a section of Kerr. The black points are the ring singularity in the section. The blue curves are these geodesics coming in. And the purple curves are the hypersurfaces. So you can build light cones for Kerr in this way. So they call these quasi-spherical light cones. So what I think is so interesting about this, usually when people show you a Penrose diagram of Kerr, I would call it sort of, I don't know, an unusual Penrose diagram. Because it's not that the diagram is a point cross S2 in the standard picture. It's a theta equals constant section of a point. So what this Pretorius and Israel construction shows is that you can build a standard Penrose diagram for Kerr. And it looks exactly the same. So there's nothing wrong with the pictures we've been looking at. But now it really is a point cross topological S2. They're these quasi-spherical light cones. So the reason that I think this is so interesting is that now we have exactly the same sort of structure I showed you as, in terms of Penrose diagrams for the black to white hole transition. So you can repeat the construction in a very similar way. The only thing that's unusual is that you can't, or at least I haven't been able to yet, glue Minkowski space on the interior of the shell. So you have to find some other vacuum solution of the Einstein equations if you want to glue in a nice interior. This is related to a long history of Einstein looking for Mach's principle in rotating frames. Nonetheless, if you take that same naive estimate of quantum effects, you do find that they're large macroscopic distance outside of the horizon. The thing that Lee was mentioning, the Kretschmann invariant intriguingly becomes negative outside of the horizon. This, I think, is signaling that gravitomagnetic effects are dominating over gravitoelectric effects. And so you work with the square here. I'll leave these conclusions up, and thank you so much.
So you mentioned briefly that the Kretschmann scalar becomes negative close to
the outer horizon.
So then Q has a zero.
Yeah.
But that means, what does that mean then for Q being a measure of classicality? If there is a region where it's zero, does it mean
the way we were interpreting it, it would mean the space-time was very classical near that point, right? So we were saying that Q very small is classical, and Q being large is going into a quantum region. This is a measure, it's an estimate of how large the curvature and the time scale for bounce is at that position. So at that position, it would say the space-time behaves very classically. I should thank my collaborators. So this was done with three undergraduates, Zetchen, Max, and Victoria. Zetchen and Max worked on the tunneling in the inverse square. Victoria worked on the rotating black hole. An assistant visiting professor at Bard, Eleni, who worked on the potential also, and with Carlo.
One question about the sort of relation between the first and second part, or maybe it's first half of the first part of the second. But you talked a lot about Picard-Lefschetz. I think it's related to the earlier question, too. But But, and then you'd show just some complex, or you said you're looking for a complex solution, but is there any hope of finding what is the, whatever it's called, Lefschetz symbol or something?
So
this path integral that you're trying to do, or,
yeah.
Or to put it another way, if you end up with some semi-classical approximation, how do you know it was justifiable that the deformation you had to do of the original path integral contour
mm-hmm.
was validly, you know, could go through that saddle point?
So in the case of a general gravitational path integral, I don't personally have any hope of finding the Lefschetz thimble. The thing that I think gives you an opportunity here is the spherical reduction. So that's what I'm investigating, is imposing this MIDI superspace reduction and then seeing if I can actually find the Lefschetz thimble in that case.
You also have to compute these intersection numbers or something like that.
Right. That's right. So the analogy would be like when I showed you the Feynman propagator in the quantum mechanical case, you notice that to make the arguments I made, I didn't try and do the full path integral. I first went to this Goetz-Wheeler, and then I did a Fourier transform, and that made it into a one-dimensional oscillatory integral where I can do the analysis. So I'm trying to use spherical symmetry to do that kind of a reduction.
But you're not assuming the Goetz-Wheeler trace formula? Or?
No. I just mean that's an analogy. I'm trying to reduce it to a one-dimensional or a finite-dimensional integral that I can then do the Picard-Lefschetz technique on.
So is that your sort of strategy for finding this complex solution?
Yeah.
They have to put a metric on the space
of all
spherical metrics.
Spherical metrics.
How many variables do we have? One.
Yeah, so in this Kukash reduction, you can think of it as a two variable system.
Is there any obstruction to getting the answer? I mean,
I can't tell yet.
Approximated it numerically or something?
That's a good question. For me, it's early days trying to do these things. That's why I didn't try to report about my thinking. I think there's still plenty of wiggle room. I'll let you know.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.